La base virale VPS a été mise à jour.
Hi everyone, we are going to start the second part of the Lightning Talks. We'll have the final number. We'll have about 10 Lightning Talks in a row. The rule is still the same, 3 minutes presentation plus 2 minutes discussion. So I'm sharing this session with Ian Jacobs. And if you don't mind, we'll start now. I would like to present you the first speaker, Christian Sons from DFKI. Christian is going to talk about 3D on the web, and as far as I understand, he wants to start an incubator on that topic, and he'll present that now. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Marie-Claire. I will try to explain to you why we think that the W3C should have an answer for declarative 3D, and why we want to start an incubator group for that. So 3D graphics is a commodity for all of you. Most of you that have a smartphone have a GPU in it. Most of the browsers use the GPU to render 2D content, but still there's hardly any 3D content on the web. And if there's 3D content, then the content is made by experts for specialized APIs, for specialized game engines, and the other way around. So you need really experts to create 3D contents. So we think we have to adapt 3D graphics for the web. So our main focus is to integrate the 3D content into HTML. Because if it's in HTML, it's in the DOM, and the 3D data perfectly fits into the DOM, it's structured data. And so we have first-class DOM objects, and millions of web programmers know how to address those 3D objects, to place an on-mouse over event on it and modify the whole 3D scene. Use jQuery if you don't like the DOM API. So you have an API that's well-known on the one side. On the other side, you have a document, and so you can share 3D content between each other. You can mesh up more complicated 3D content. So we think that W3C should play an important role in this. I can't go into details why we shouldn't use another format for that. WebGL is a really good start for it, but it's not the answer for declarative 3D, of course. There are two 3D HTML integration projects. One is the XML3D project that tries to be to design an extension to HTML to provide interactive 3D graphics, and tries to reuse the whole W3C technology stack as far as possible. And then there's the second project, the X3DOM project, from my colleague Johannes. He will show some demos later that tries to streamline the X3D concepts and then add W3C technologies to it. So we have really different approaches, but in the end we have quite similar results by using HTML elements, using CSS as much as possible. We use CSS3 animations and 3D transforms, for example. Of course, we have to add 3D specific items like 3D events and programmable concepts that's important for 3D content. We have XML3D, that's our project. We have different implementations in the Mozilla browser and Google Chromium that support XML3D. We have a WebGL implementation, so just check out our website for that. So as a short summary for that, 3D will be a hot topic on the web, and we will launch an incubator group, and we would like to invite you to participate into this group to get the industrial strength for this working group. For this incubator group. So that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Tristan.
Questions?
So, any questions? And I believe that you wanted to run a video while we have questions, Christian?
Yeah.
Okay. So, while they are preparing for the demonstration. No, it's not a question.
Okay.
So, I'm from the Fraunhofer IGD. I'm from the X Freedom Project, which
near the mic,
is.
Please. Near the mic.
Sorry. Which was a project that was just mentioned, so I just rush over the slides so, because I would like to show a couple videos. So the idea is not to build new nodes, but using existing scene graphs, X3D scene graph. There's this long history of ideas how to integrate X3D into HTML. There's this, the Web3D consortium is a liaison for years, and it was already in the spec, and we developed the project 2009 out of a code base from Philip Taylor and integrated it first, and we showed it last year and developed it over a full layer, a full JavaScript layer that can use a traditional plugin or a native implementation or WebGL for rendering. So you just add these two lines of JavaScript code to your HTML page and suddenly get 3D data in your HTML. Application. There were a couple of third-party application developers that already use the system as it is, as we presented it last year at the TPEC over the last 12 months. And I would like to show two, three demos. So first of all, in general, to add the idea again, so what we have is so you have a specific subtree in your HTML page that endlich similar to a canvas defines a 2D size, and there are all your 3D objects. And then since it's in your DOM, you can just use a simple append child and remove child to add 3D objects. So no specific plugin or user or API is needed. You can remove childs easily, but you can also use just a jQuery slider on your data. Oh, and it's not working right now? Okay. I don't know. Okay, but what you also can do is you can use, for example, MPEG-4 movies on textures, because you can reuse canvas and images and movies as textures inside of your 3D world. So it's not just that 3D there, but we can also use 2D elements from HTML inside of that declarative form of 3D. So it's very, very fast, very, very easy. There's no single line of JavaScript code there to do any animation. All the animation is done with CSS3, D animation, and 3D transformation. And what's also there that you can, for example, click on a 3D object and it's using extended mouse event, so a DOM level 2 mouse event with a couple of additional attributes, so you get the 3D position and color and everything. Okay. And just maybe as an inspiration, some application areas where this 3D, declarative 3D is really, really useful. For example, augmented reality. Right here, it's using the WebGL implementation of the system running on top of Flash, because right now we don't have any API in the W3C stack that allows us to get the data from the camera. And with the device extension, we probably would get the data, but the stream, but not the pixels. So what still would be needed is some form of API to access a pixel. So similar to what the audio incubator group did for the PCM chunks, there should be some interfaces that really allow us to read the pixels from the video cam. So just as an inspiration there, we work already closely with a point of interest group and so see where this goes. So if you're interested in declarative 3D, join this incubator group we are founding together and join forces on here. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Questions from the audience?
Sorry, it's not a question, it's actually a statement. Something that I'm noting here. I remember going to a SIGGRAPH conference in, I think it was 1991, as a student, and thinking and seeing a lot of demos of interesting new technologies around computer graphics. And what I'm seeing here today around so many demos around 3D web technologies greatly reminds me of that in some way. And I'm not saying that to put it down, by the way, right, at all, because since 1991, we've had an enormous industry built up around computer graphics, and everybody at that time thought it was just kind of a toy. I think we're at the same point. It seems to me we must be at the same point here. I can almost see an entirely new industry, a new medium emerging around this stuff, and I think it's extremely exciting.
So. I thought it was just so hard to use. They had all the different plugins, different forms, and what important really is that you get it really, really into the DOM or really, really close. So HTML programmer can use it, and it's really there.
That's exactly the point. It's a little bit comparable to video. In video, we have the infrastructure since like 10 years to cut video, to compress video. But video took off when video was available in the web. So we hope that the same can be applied on 3D graphics. So the infrastructure is now there. GPUs are in every device, more or less. And we just have to lift off now in the web.
If there are no more questions, we'll move on. Thank you again. So we are going to have a smooth transition to points of interest in augmented reality. And this presentation is will be done by Matt Womer from W3C.
Hi. I don't have my slides. I just lost the screen that I had my notes to. All right, well, this is going to eat up a few minutes of the 3 minutes section. So I'm giving these slides on behalf of Andy Braun, who couldn't be here today. He's the chairperson of the new Points of Interest Working Group. He sent me his notes, and I'm going to try to stick to them as close as possible. This one was labeled with joke. I tried to racked my brain to come up with a joke that fit this image. I don't know what he was going for, really. But the text was that the internet, this series of tubes we all joke about, the tubes have become more and more detached. We're now taking the internet with us everywhere, and the paradigm has changed. We're no longer just using the internet to do research at our desktops. And this has introduced a whole new slew of user interface paradigms for viewing this information when we're on the go. This is a primitive augmented reality app. And so augmented reality has become one of these hot topics. Dan, who was just here asking a question a moment ago, charged the W3C with looking into augmented reality and how we can work with augmented reality and web standards, how they can work together at the AC meeting last March. And in response, my colleague Phil held a workshop on augmented reality. It was widely attended. You can find out more about that on our website. But everybody got together, all these augmented reality experts got together, they looked at what were the obvious points where standardization was ready and ripe in augmented reality, and they decided that representing information about locations and places in a standardized web-friendly way would be sort of the low-hanging fruit of augmented reality and web standards. So we started looking into launching a group, and we realized that there's more uses to these points of interest data than just augmented reality. There's things like these checking games, Foursquare, Gowalla, Scavenger, those sort of things. Not to mention there's also just the all the apps that we've been using all along that have geographic information embedded in them, you know, navigation apps and maps and searching and Wikipedia. So this led us to launch the points of interest working group. So what we're doing within this group is developing a standardized way of representing, you know, information about places. We just launched 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, and we've had 2 conference calls so far, but we've been going pretty hard on our public mailing list, and I just want to encourage everybody to join. And in addition, we're also using this working group as sort of a way for us to look for future places where, you know, within augmented reality and web standards, where the two coincide. So we'll also be doing sort of a survey of what's out there, what standards are already in place or in progress that can be used to enable augmented reality. And we'll see how they all work together and try to make them fit into the web framework. So if you want to check it out, it's w3.org/2010/POI. I encourage you all to look at it and join us. So thank you very much. That was it.
Thanks, Matt.
Any questions? All right. Thank you.
Next, we have Martin Kliem, who's going to speak to us about thoughts on Canvas 3D.
Okay, my name is Martin Kliem. I'm a member of the HTML Working Group and the HTML Accessibility Task Force. And I want to talk a bit about Canvas 3D accessibility. We faced a couple of challenges on 2D content. Here is Canvas 2D. Originally, people thought it might be cool that people draw patterns on a bitmap, which isn't really that interesting. It's a bit more interesting to have that wet floor effect on a photo in Canvas, but soon we saw that people are getting creative, and that, for example, is something where somebody wrote an emulator in JavaScript using the original Space Invaders code, and now you can play Space Invaders in your browser with Canvas. So what we learned from it is, if you give people the right tools, they will do anything with it, with Canvas in that case. For example, writing a rich text editor like Mozilla did with B-Spin, which is now the default editor as far as I'm informed for Jetpack. So what we certainly need is some fallback content for a Canvas. Here in that case, we have an image, so that's quite easy. That fallback content in a 2D context provides a shadow DOM that is always exposed to assistive technology. Normally, fallback content would only be exposed if the browser doesn't support that specific element, but in that case, we want it always to be accessible and keyboard accessible in a browser for people with assistive technologies like screen readers. Further, what we think is important, if it's keyboard accessible, it can get focus, and so we need a focus ring on the bitmap around that element. Also, a caret position might be important for editing text. So that was the 2D context, but we face a couple of challenges in the 3D context that differ. already a couple of games have begun to appear. This is a very early demo of Infinite Journey, a jump and run adventure with WebGL in a 3D context. And in games, here is a screenshot from World of Warcraft that doesn't run in your browser yet, but that will be the future, I guess. Games are one major use case for 3D in a browser. In virtual world, in a game, usually you have only a limited number of characters facing you where you can interact with a limited number of objects that are usually created by the game makers, so they are defined. They have alternative texts and names. But the main challenge in a game is reaction time. So there are a couple of things that help people with disabilities to play those games. Like audio cues, ear cons, that's like icons, but sound hints, sound radar to know where your enemies are, tactile feedback like vibration, speech synthesis, and one problem is hardware acceleration, because these games go directly to the GPU and we have no access to the GPU, so the whole accessibility API is outside of it. That's one problem. Looking into social worlds like Second Life, you have other problems, like there's a lot of user-generated content without accessible text, same as in the web. So you have to focus in, you have to filter nearby objects like anything that's within 20 meters of somebody. On average, there are 13 objects in a 20-meter range, and you have to summarize objects. Also, screen reader support is essential because screen reader users customize their screen readers a lot. If you want to know more, Elke Vollmer is the person to ask. He wrote a lot of studies about that. My plea would be that the W3C gets into contact with all stakeholders and vice versa, because bolt-on accessibility is ugly and expensive, whereas inclusive design and built-in accessibility from the beginning is beautiful and also good for your health. And that's it. Thanks.
Back to the wines. Oh, okay, so any questions for Martin Klim? And talking about the games, I'll just remind you that tomorrow night we'll have a WPC meetup from 7 to 9 happening in this convention center, level 1. There will be the local gaming industry participating and also presenting, so you're welcome to have discussions with them. It's going to be like a networking event mainly. So, no questions. Next speaker is Mohamed Zargawi from InnovaMax. He's going to talk about XML performance. And he wants to create a working group, I believe.
Or something else. Hello, everybody. I'm just going to speak to you about XML and performance. Just on this morning, I heard, I think it was someone from Microsoft saying that performance is a feature that everyone likes to have. It's, I think it's really true, especially for XML. Just a quick poll. You can hum, you can raise your hand, you can hit look for, I don't know. Who cares about XML in this room? Okay. Oh, impressive. Okay. Who cares about the web in this room? Okay, exactly. The same people. Very good. So recently, the W3C has created a group named Web Performance to be able to give the chance to the web to have tools to develop a way to generate and to evaluate performance in the web. So that's on the same track that I wanted to go this way. So okay, this way, okay. So the goal of this, it could be an interest group, a working group anyway. So the idea is to gather people, companies interested in giving a new way to XML to express this power through performance. So today XML is still perceived as slow and fat. That's a fact. And even if this in this room we can find probably half of the people thinking that. And that's a real problem if we try to get in the industry where people want to have something very with high performance, high throughput, and dealing with high volume of data. But standards now and products are now mature, and the whole toolchain is now viable. We can have now a whole toolchain of products around XML that behave in a very good manner and that are very efficient in the way of dealing into XML. For example, if we just take the speed, now we have native XML databases that are very efficient. Products are now more and more efficient every day. Fast XML transformation, we have now a new standard that's come this year that is XProc, which is about fast transformation, and there is a lot of work in this area to bring a tool that might perform more and more efficiently than it was before. Fast validation, the working groups in this area are trying now to focus on performance and bringing new feature as well as a very important performance. For example, there is a work you probably know, is XSLT3. It was named XSLT 2.1 once ago. And it's around streaming processing. It's not only about that, but this is the one area of improving performance of XML. And also multi-threading, we can say all the things about the cloud and bringing XML to the cloud and stuff like that. The other side of this work is the size, and there is a lot of work around binary XML, which is very interesting to keep all the infoset of XML and trying to get around the size of the document exchanged between the elements to be transformed, for example, and the regular debate between events and DOM structure in the area of XML. So now we are missing tools to encourage and improve performance. We don't have performance test suite, and in the XML area, we have a test suite for a lot of things, but not for performance. And we are missing communication around actual XML tools performance, use cases, success stories, and stuff like that. So the first interesting step is probably to gather people to workshop today to be defined. So every people interested, just send me an email. My name is Mohamed Zaghawi. It's innovimax@gmail.com, for example. And we can just gather the way to make this happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So again, contact Mohamed if you're interested in that. Any questions while we change laptops? Yes, thank you.
This is Frederick Hirsch, Nokia. I'm chairing the XML Security Working Group, and we have been doing work on a 2.0 of XML signature to improve performance related to that.
Roger?
There was certainly a test suite associated with EXI. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, definitely. But it's not on the whole toolchain of XML. The idea is just not focus on EXI, but all the toolchain of validation, transformation, and dealing with pipelining in general. But it wasn't the case, for example, in XQuery and XSLT, just to give it as a point. Or XML schema.
Okay, everyone hear me at the back? We awake, yes. Am I rolling? Are we going?
Go.
3, 2, 1, go. How many people here have heard of App Font Face? Hands up, please. How many people have heard of WAF? How many people had to decide whether to use one or the other? No? Okay, good. Thank you, Michael. Go. Okay, so you know, big new thing, web fonts, everyone's talking about it on the blogs, hot new thing, actually not that new. So some history. CSS2, 1998, had web fonts, had at font face, you could download, you could synthesize, you could do intelligent matching, so-called to differentiate from unintelligent matching. You could do all sorts of stuff. The problem was that was the same time as there was a format war. So the working group decided on a syntax for style sheets, but didn't decide on what you could actually point to. Naturally, that meant that it didn't work. People had to make stuff twice on two different platforms for both browsers, and they couldn't be bothered, frankly, and therefore it didn't work. So SVG had a look at that and went, okay, let's drop the bits that don't work, and let's mandate a format, and that worked very well on some platforms. Basically, on mobile, it worked very well. But on the desktop, people weren't so keen on that. They didn't want that format, so problem. We then skip over the intervening 5 years or so of massive confusion. And we get to WAF. What happened with WAF? Well, for one thing, we had font designers talking to browser vendors. And I say talking as opposed to shouting. This was a difference. Also, instead of people saying, you're going to steal my fonts, they were saying, oh, so there's a business model here. We can actually have a license that actually explicitly says whether you can use it on the web or not. And we can sell you the same font twice, once for print, once for the web. Cool. So therefore, we have a working group. And since this is a lightning talk, you know all about the next steps. You know you have a working draft, you have last call, candidate recommendation where you test stuff, and then a proposed recommendation and recommendation. I'm skipping through those very fast because we expect to go through it very fast as well. We're going to last call tomorrow, hopefully, and CR, hopefully, in about a month. Ha. See if we don't. So what is WAF? This is where I get into all the boring technical details about bytecodes and whatever, which you really don't care about, do you? So I'll just intrigue you by saying it's not a font format. OFF is the ISO version of OpenType, which is a font format. So what it actually is some compressed font tables and some optional license bits and stuff like that, so you can actually find out what the license is. And a little binary blob, which we pretend isn't there, but sometimes founders like to stick that in. And OK, fine. But more importantly, what can you do with it? By itself, nothing. But with a document language and a style sheet language all used together, you can do some quite interesting things. And yes, the bad news is that, am I really 3 minutes already? Damn. Well, I'm going to have another minute, so there. So yes, it's going to be like DTP all over again. There's going to be a splash of fonts all over the web, and it's going to look awful for a bit. But there we are, never mind. But you're also going to be able to have multiple weights, more than two. Honestly, really more. Look, there's nine. You'll be able to use different scripts, like different Unicode languages, stuff like that. You'll be able to have text which is accessible. What you get at the moment is some font designer going, oh, I've got to put it just like this and just like this, and take a screenshot and stick it in the web page, and it looks beautiful. And you've got a bunch of pixels, and you can't search on it, and it's not accessible. So if you've got dependable downloadable fonts, then it works. You also have these things. Look, that's the same text three times, but it doesn't look the same. So's that. So's that. So fonts come a long way. Types come a long way. There we go. Done. Ian's telling me I have to show you my T-shirt. OK, so here's my T-shirt. It says WAF on the front. On the back.
Show off with WAF.
We have a question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Hi, my name is Arthur Ortega. I'm from Yahoo. And I have a question. I already have a problem on operating systems when Wingbutts fonts are used or similar other fonts that are displaying any kind of symbols, or sometimes even combined symbols like an integral by using two characters. How is this addressed to the textual alternative that is exposed?
So basically, when people do that, they're doing a hack because they're having to depend on a very small number of fonts which they fondly believe are available on all systems, which they aren't, by the way. But anyway, that's what they're doing. So when you see Greek, which isn't really Greek, but it's symbol font stuck on ASCII, that's a hack.
Yes, but
having downloadable fonts and depending on Unicode means that if you want an integral symbol, you provide the font which has a symbol for the integral, not top half and bottom half and let's slap them together and blah.
Yep, but if you have wingbots like a flying pigeon, what happens to that if it's a character, it would be a B or something?
Microphone, please, Roman.
So, Arthur, there is actually a file from the Unicode Consortium that actually has descriptions of all the characters. It has three-quarter black circle with white opening on the top right corner in it. Go take a look at it.
Now, I'm not looking for the Unicode characters. I'm looking for the WAF files that you can create for characters that are not available in Unicode. But that's the question.
You can use a free font editor called FontForge, and if you're capable of drawing the glyph, then you can produce a font. And you can have a font that only has, you know, six characters in it. If those are characters of interest to you, no problem.
What happens to accessibility?
What happens to?
Accessibility if they use like images.
Well, you're not using images, you're using text.
Yes, but if the text is not the text, but some other images that you are displaying, like glyphs.
Well, you don't do that.
More comments? Thomas, are you ready?
We are saying and hearing a lot of good things about HTML5. We are all betting big on it, and I think we all believe it will be the lingua franca for web apps, as Ballmer just said last week. But that is not all the public discourse that we see about it. There are some people who have concerns, and there are some people who think you're not nearly frightened enough about its security and its privacy. There are privacy commissioners talking about privacy by design again. That's a resolution the Conference of Privacy Commissioners adopted last week in Israel. And there is EverCookie, just one example among many. An HTML5 loophole is the reporting, and in reality, a concoction of cookies and flash storage and client-side storage and HTTP caching and Canvas. Canvas? Yes, Canvas, it's used. And the naive reaction is, terrible. We've got a hole in the Canvas API, we need to fix it. That's wrong. We have architectural properties, we have access to data within one origin, we have the ability for a site to persist data on the client. That means we have the technology as part of the architecture to track users, and by the way, the majority of users, and that includes myself, actually accept cookies and take cookies. So how is EverCookie different? EverCookie forces state on the client and enables tracking for users who have actually tried to use the tools at their disposal to get rid of that tracking, who have tried the tools at their disposal to delete the cookies, but the tools don't catch the other state, the tools don't catch the other technology that gets used. What does this mean? We need a much broader discourse on web privacy. We need to talk about responsibilities. We need to talk about the browser feature to actually get rid of all that state and not just the cookie. We need to talk about what our role as an organization is. We've taken first steps with two privacy workshops this year. In July, motivated out of the Device API Working Group, we talked about privacy for device APIs. In October, we talked about privacy, about policies approaches. We talked about a broader perspective to privacy. In December, we are organizing a workshop with ISOC, with the Internet Architecture Board, also at MIT, to talk about the broader picture. Additionally, in the hallways here, there have been numerous conversations already about what the next steps for the W3C privacy activity should look like. If you're interested in that, Rigo and I are both around. Please corner us in the hallways. We are very eager to talk. If you're interested in joining us in December for the workshop, the deadline is on 5 November. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Then I request.
Dan Applequist, Vodafone, and the tag in this instance. So I think I was one of those people who you might have characterized my comments to you or on a mailing list or somewhere as being, let's fix Canvas, for instance. I didn't say that, so I'm not saying that now. But I also don't buy the as intended argument that I think I hear you saying. I think just because Canvas is working as intended and all the other technologies are working as intended doesn't mean there isn't a problem that EverCookie has pointed out that we should be addressing tactically as well as looking at the long-term big picture umbrella, blue sky, 30,000 foot, et cetera, view.
So I had not said that you said fix Canvas, and so I'll take the opportunity to be more clear about one point I said. What Canvas does here is work within the concept of a security model that we have here. It is a mere conduit to read data back that you have previously persisted. How we control that persistent state, how we control what web applications do, how we let users control how they interact with these applications, how we empower users, how we perhaps hold providers of applications accountable, are the problems we need to solve.
Yes, David?
Just a quick supportive comment. I'm not sure how far the penumbra of worrying about privacy in general goes, but I'm fairly sure that we need to be worried about the privacy implications of simply implementing the specifications we write. If people implement to our specifications straightforwardly, we should not be leading them into privacy violations unknowingly. And that I'm concerned that we continue to do that.
And addressing that is one of the reasons why we organized the workshop in December. It is specifically aiming at the spec writers. It is going across standards organizations, across the ITF, IAB, and W3C. That is precisely the question we are aiming at with that workshop.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Alexandre Monin from the University Panthéon-Sorbonne Paris 1 will talk to us about the web and philosophy.
Okay, so indeed, my name is Alexandre Monin, and I organized the first international web and philosophy event in the world. I'm here to present it to you. So this event was funded by my university, Paris 1, Panthéon-Sorbonne, in Ria. This was probably the first collaboration between the two institutions and the French National Agency for Research, with the support of my employer, the Institute for Research and Innovation, W3C, thank you, and two associations for computing and philosophy and ontology and its applications. So before the conference itself, I created an official Dailymotion account where I conducted interviews that I published with people and experts in the field, in knowledge engineering, and with the participants. It's still online and available. So the participants were philosophers, engineers, and computer scientists, or rather a mix between the three. You had engineers with philosophical background, like Henry Storey, that you probably know. Computer scientists were also philosophers, like Harry Halpin, the first who came up with the idea of philosophy of the web. Philosophers who work on the web and with the web, like myself or Yuk Hui. Philosophers whose work is being used by engineers, and philosophers whose work belong to philosophy but might nonetheless have practical applications in knowledge engineering. Okay, so the topics, I have no time to summarize them, but we discussed ontology, UIs, memory and archive, collective intelligence, social issues, you pick up. So What are the immediate results? Of course, the abstracts are available online, the recordings will be posted on Dailymotion, and the slides are released on SlideShare. But there are more than that. We announced with Harry and Hugh the creation of the IAWP, International Association for Web and Philosophy. We would like the papers to appear in a journal, a special issue about the philosophy of the web. We have a research project in France with Harry, I can say that. And I'm still conducting interviews about web and philosophy with experts. Some agreed to do more in the future. And if Tim Berners-Lee agrees to do one with me, I will be very happy. So, in my mind, this was never Alexander Menin's PhiloWeb, but rather PhiloWeb 2010, which means new installments are underway. One at Goldsmiths in London, thanks to Yuk Yuhi, and another one at Mountain View in the Googleplex, thanks to Harry, who convinced Peter Norvig to host it. So, in conclusion, I believe we cannot ignore the web and go on philosophizing as if it did not exist. Some people already do philosophy of the web, according to Henry Thompson at least, and I agree with him. There are the people of the tag who take care of it and try to build and understand it. I believe we philosophers with a strong interest in the web, philosophical, practical, and political, are de facto working as philosophical engineers. This is a matter of responsibility. Some of our concepts, one becoming artifacts, what I call artifactualized, give birth to concrete objects, technical systems, and standards with ethical, juridical, economical dimensions and consequences. We cannot ignore that. Current work on the web of objects should also inspire new collaborations between philosophers and engineers. Thanks. You can find the links to the website, the videos, and the slides in my last slide. Thanks.
Thank you, Alexandre. So, would like to raise a comment or a question for related to web and philosophy.
just a quick comment. A lot of the web stuff that's going on seems to be drawing in artificial intelligence work for the last 10 years or so. And it also seems a lot of AI people were philosophers at the time. It's no accident, I guess, that Norvig got involved. Have you been using that connection? Where's he gone?
Yes, there is definitely a connection, but I think Harry, who, if he's still there, could speak about it better than I do. Because, for example, his talk was about comparing AI and collective intelligence. So we're trying to understand the current state of the web, but of course, AI is very interesting. There are many brands of AI, of course. So when you want to look at philosophical concepts that are put in machines or in objects, of course, AI is probably the first place to go. But I think it's the same thing with the web, but it works.
Thomas
Rössler, W3C. To state the perhaps obvious, I think the privacy challenges that we face are partially practical. Many of them, though, are squarely within your discipline. I look forward to seeing you guys invest your brains into that topic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Alexandre. And now, Ian Jacobs, who is going to present you the WFC community groups.
Hello, everyone. Because it's the end of the afternoon and because we're in France, I thought I would do my lightning talk in mime. So if you'll bear with me. Actually, no, I'm not going to do that. I thought seriously about doing that, but I'm not the mime type. So thank you. Yeah, it's been a long time I've been waiting to say that. So, it is great to see everybody and to hear all the impressive lightning talks and all of the new work that people are proposing that W3C take up. But I do have a question, which is, why aren't more people here? It was good to see people sitting on the floor earlier today, but instead of there being 300 people here, why aren't there 600 people? There's so many things that are exciting going on. Why aren't there more people here? Well, we asked a number of them. We set up a task force, and we started to have conversations with people both inside and outside W3C. And this is what we heard. It's too expensive. That's one you hear frequently. The culture is unfamiliar to me. I don't know what the semantic web is. I don't want to have to use namespaces. I don't like prefixes, or I don't know the people who are at W3C. The process is intimidating. But even though they cited a number of barriers, and we documented 40 or 50 of them, they also saw a great value proposition for W3C, including its reputation and its neutrality and its international audience and its liaisons with governments and other standards bodies. And they said, we would love to bring work to W3C if only there were a mechanism to do so. So the new standards task force studied these barriers and these value propositions, and they came up with a concept called community groups. Now, sort of the primary use case that they were considering along the way was a group of people, some of whom may work for W3C members, some who may not, are interested in something they're starting to work on. They're not really ready for a big consensus. They want some IPR protection. So it doesn't sound like the W3C recommendation track. So we came up with a new track. And some of the features of our track to welcome innovation included anybody may participate at zero cost. Groups have no time limit. A lot of times we hear groups say, oh, I just want to have my community be able to keep going, and that's sort of inconsistent with our current chartering model. We want a balanced IPR policy. We want lightweight commitments up front, but companies who are also interested in this technology want some sort of safety, and so can we find the right balance? It turned out that the folks at the Open Web Foundation had come up with a policy, and if you follow the link from that page, you'll find out our draft IPR policy for community groups that really does strike a nice balance, and the more I talk about it with people, the more they suggest we may be onto something. So, and one last key feature, smooth transition to the standards track, but we don't expect everything to go to the standards track, only the things that the community is interested in taking to the standards track, and there are some benefits for doing the work at W3C to make it easier to get to the standards track. We also don't expect all work to go on at W3C, even in community groups, so we have some bits in there for liaisons with the community. So the progression is quite simple. There'll be a forum with a little support. We can make it a nice, flashy, shiny new forum for people to bring new ideas. Once there's enough support from the community to branch off a community group, that happens. And in the short term, I hope it will happen automatically. And they will build momentum, ultimately producing something called a W3C community specification. It'll look different from the standards track documents. And then those documents themselves will benefit from IPR commitments and be prepared to advance to the standards track if the community wants to. So I mentioned that the community groups have zero cost to participate. There's also zero revenue anticipated from them. So we created two other group types. One are called business groups, where there's a little bit more staff connectivity, not a staff contact, but a little more staff interaction for those who want to bring together their partners to apply W3C technologies to business applications. And a second type of group called a use case and requirements group where, again, we can sort of focus efforts to channel requirements to a working group. And the benefit there is for a fee is high bandwidth connectivity between chairs. So we're doing all this because bringing in innovators to W3C enhances the reputation of the organization, brings new ideas, constructive participation improves the quality of our work. It helps W3C scale so that we go beyond the staff and raise the number of people who are coming up in the standards process, and of course helps us connect to new customers. So please do tell us your ideas for community groups. We hope to have this up and running over the next few months, and if you have any questions, there are links to the proposal in the slide set. Thank you.
Thank you. Ayan, are you waiting for questions, ideas for community groups? Or are you going to offer free hugs? Who wants to go to the mic?
So, I'm Mike Champion, Microsoft Corporation. I'm here to give a pretty, I asked for a space on the program right after Ian for to give a very simple message that Microsoft pretty much officially gives a plus one to this idea. That I participated in this task force and I brought in ideas that are supported by significantly high management people. So the reason for this is also pretty straightforward. Microsoft, as our presentations this morning, I hope made clear, wants to see the next generation of web standards be innovated at W3C. But in order to make that happen, there do need to be some process innovations. The discussions need to be open to non-members, as Ian talked about, and the community of people that in one of these community needs to be the one responsible for driving the consensus, ensuring the quality, and what their sense of the architectural coherence is. They don't need to, you know, to be slowed down by having to get consensus among all the stakeholders in W3C in order to get good ideas on the table and brainstormed. So the use case we see for this, and the most straightforward one, is a person or a small group of people have some idea for what the next generation web could incorporate. And they want a way to get a proposal, you know, uploaded somewhere and visible to a wide range of people who could provide some sort of commentary on it. Possibly put their passion into it. And as Ian talked about, in order to make that happen with some confidence, people need to do that under a straightforward IPR policy, and we agree that the Open Web Foundation agreement is a great template for that. All sorts of reasons we can go into in depth, but I'll just say we concur with what Ian said about it. It's great to have options to, you know, create a community specification, an eventual recommendation track document, and given the announcement yesterday about W3C's past submitter status, potentially an international standard. So your idea that, you know, you and somebody sitting around over coffee come up with, you know, could in 5 years become an international standard with a lot less impedance than it would take right now. But also, we wanted to see that happen under the W3C umbrella, but we realized from the task force research that people don't want to sell their soul to W3C in order to start brainstorming ideas here. They want to potentially take advantage of our community, our larger community, but they don't want to be, you know, tied to it forever. So Ian talked about some, you know, ask people to throw out ideas. The IE team and I kind of brainstormed this little list I have up here. The last one about 3D Canvas is, well, we don't need to talk about that. It's got a lot of attention here. That's great. But here's just sort of an idea that we kicked around. All the browsers have some sort of debugging console API. So, well, I mean, let's hear from the community. Do we need a standard for this, or is this just something that, you know, everybody can just innovate in their own way and serve their own users? I don't know. We don't know. Let's talk about it. We talked in various meetings this week about the idea of, you know, profiling some of the W3C standards. For instance, for email. Well, it's not something that we're going to, you know, gear up a working group to do, but yeah, Why not a community forum of some sort? See, is there really enough energy to take that idea anywhere? I don't know. We can talk about it. So some other things. I don't know. I'm not the person to go into detail on any of these, but you know, jQuery node lists is a really powerful idea. How do we? Is it worth incorporating that into the other web APIs at the cost of some churn? Or again, I don't know. Likewise, there's all sorts of possibilities we've talked about this week about getting the end users, the you know, the web developer community, web publishers involved in discussions of what the real interoperable subset of the specs is. So anyway, these are just ideas we're throwing out. These are not the official Microsoft position, only the endorsement of what Ian presented to you. Thank you.
I just want to make one little clarification. So I mentioned the Open Web Foundation licenses, which the current proposal basically adapts them to a W3C context. So we're working closely with David Rudin and Larry Rosen and others. I don't think we would be using them as is, but those licenses themselves are forkable, and we're in very close contact with that group. So just a clarification.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, please go ahead, Roger.
Roger Cutler, Chevron. What mechanism would prevent a community group or from doing something that was unethical, offensive, or illegal, or something else under the that you would not want under the umbrella of the W3C?
That's called a business group.
Ha.
We have planned for a couple of social mechanisms. Again, we sort of, the idea was let things happen as automatically and quickly as possible and then correct them afterwards if there are issues. So for example, if a group came up and was doing something unethical or illegal, I mean, we sort of don't want to pass judgment too much, but we would have mechanisms in place. There's a task force that would be set up to sort of monitor the community groups and make sure they're functioning well, help mentor people coming into the process, and sort of look out for this sort of situation. So there's another bit which has to do with W3C's current experience with community discussions. Sometimes they get heated, and I've talked to people like Tantek Celik and others about other ideas for managing community discussions. So, you know, our goal is, as we open up, we may have people who are unfamiliar with some of the things the people in the room know how to do, and so we plan for mechanisms to help sort of train people and keep an eye on things. Daniel?
Yes, you mentioned one of the topics, HTML and email, and I want to comment on that because we held an HTML and email workshop in the consortium a few years ago. You mentioned a profile. I have a profile for you, HTML3.2 without CSS. And one of the main reasons why we have to deprecate the quality, sorry, downgrade the quality of HTML for email, I'm sorry, it's Microsoft email products, because you change the rendering engine between each version of Outlook, and it's not compatible. It's absolutely impossible to use modern specs in email, and you have companies making huge businesses trying to turn a newsletter from a given company into suitable email for every mail user agent. So it's not a problem of spec, it's a problem of rendering engine and MUAs.
Thank you. Any other questions about community groups?
I have a question as well.
Yep.
One thing was, how could we get more participants into the W3C? At the German W3C Day recently, somebody asked, would you become a member of the W3C if it cost only 100 euros a year? Of course, you're the wrong people to ask that question, because somehow you made it here. But I think it will be a difference if, especially for freelancers or small agencies, if the membership fees were just 100 euros instead of 10,000.
So for the business group, so there's a general question about individual participant fees in W3C, which I won't touch on here. There's a specific question, which is in business groups, the current proposal has a $300 individual unaffiliated participation fee. So we're sort of getting closer to that goal. I should say also in passing that the community groups proposal is the result of a lot of input from people inside and outside the community, but it's also not from scratch. We have an incubator activity today, and what we've done is sort of take that experience and make it a more public sort of mechanism. So again, if you have any questions, happy to help. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So it's not going to be the end of the session now. We have like a surprise guest, Robin Mergeon. 3 minutes only, right?
Go. Okay, so it's up. Hi. So those of you who were there this morning, which I presume is most people here, might recall a small incident in which a given word was uttered. And I wanted to come back to it because there's a backstory to this. So I'm one of the co-chairs of the Device APIs Working Group, which has been going on for about a year. And we've made good progress, but we do have an image problem with a part of the web community. And I am seeking your help in order to solve it. So for some reason, which we could perhaps explain through complicated history gathering, but I doubt we'd find anything conclusive, some people seem to think, to be under the delusion, that the DAP working group is working for something called widget APIs, that are some kind of APIs structured and designed in such a way that they cannot work in a web browser. This is bullshit. What we have done is APIs that use the browser security model, that use user activation approaches similar to file upload and the such, and that integrate with HTML elements. This is the way of doing APIs properly. Now, I'm not saying we don't have bugs and that we can do some things better, but we're taking the open web, browser web, whatever you want to call it, approach to start with. We also do some things that have not been done much up to now, which is taking privacy seriously in at the time of the API design. It's not just security. It's also, for instance, minimizing the amount of information you provide for a given function without too much prompting and without driving the users crazy. We're also looking into new metaphors. For instance, there are metaphors to provide a file, to provide information, so to read something. Those exist, but there are no metaphors for deleting content. And we're only starting to see metaphors for write back in the file writer API, which used to be in DAP. Yes, we also do other stuff that might not be very browsery, and that's important too. The entire world is not a browser, but it doesn't mean that those things take precedence over actually getting the stuff to work in a browser in the first place. So why did this happen? I don't know. Are people being deliberately evil in vilifying us? I hope not. Are people dangerously uninformed? In that case, is there anything we can do to fix that? Is it a not invented here problem? We're looking at technologies that don't come from certain vendors, so they won't look at it. I don't know. I'm not pointing fingers. I'm not accusing. I'm really asking the question because it's getting to be a pain in the butt. So any solutions are welcome, but in any case, we need to move forward. Not sure how. The only thing I know is that we really want to stop the bullshit. Thank you very much, and come have a beer
with
us.
Can you turn? Robin, thank you. So I have a question for you. So, Robin, my understanding is, this is Ian Jacobs, my understanding is two communities did enter into a conversation maybe a year ago, and that helped overcome some barriers, and that they're seem to persist some today, even though it's an improvement over a year ago. What do you recommend as co-chair of the working group as the next step for sort of further lowering the barriers?
So what I would personally like is for the people who say that DAP is not producing APIs in a way that is, that fits the model they believe we should use, which we do use, to come talk to us and maybe read our specs in the first place. And it would be great to have this discussion, but it's always, oh, you're doing it wrong. Oh, sorry. Right.
So my guess is there may be some people in the room who feel like they might wish to respond to that. Or if not, then I heard Robin offer to pay for beer later. So
I'll buy the beer.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you.
So many thanks to our speakers on this session again, and many thanks to you, the audience, because it was quite long. So I hope it was still entertaining. Thank you.
Quelle est ma machine?
Elle est là.
Thanks, panelists. Great talks, very exciting. We have a few minutes now to wrap up. Before I formally wrap up the session, what we wanted to do right now is make sure that we left no stone unturned. So far we focused the agenda for most of the day on specific topics. Now's the opportunity for people to raise whatever topic they want to about anything at all related to W3C, the web, or anything else, if there is anything outside the web. And to help address whatever is on your mind at this late hour, I'd like to also invite Tim to please come up and be available for whatever folks would like to talk about.
Mohamed Zaghawi, InnoviMax. I'm also liaison with ISO SC34, which is responsible for maintenance of OpenXML, ODF, and probably in the near future, EPUB. And the question is that we have an item of work which has recently appeared about ZIP, and the fact that ZIP is very fuzzy in the terms of licensing and using it. And I know that ZIP is already used, for example, in widget packaging, and the same problem has already been tackled. And I will be very interested in feedbacks in this area from the W3C and members to help the SC34 working group to address this problem. Thank you.
Thanks for that input. I don't know offhand whether or what we've done to look at it, so if you could just ping me afterwards offline, and we'll, unless someone would like to come to the mic, if someone knows if anyone's looked at that at all. Please.
Jim Melton, Oracle. I don't know the answer to the question, but I do know that it's going to be addressed next week at the JTC 1 plenary. So possibly we'll have an answer sometime after next week.
Well, this year is it.
Great, great. And we'll be sending Danielle to the JTC 1 plenary so we can caucus there as well, if necessary. So I take it that everyone is totally satisfied with everything that's going on in W3C. No one has any complaints. We've all aired our points of view, or we're possibly very tired. A long day. Unfortunately, the reception will start when the reception starts. So we'll give it a couple more minutes. If not, I'll just get up. We'll just close the meeting. And number of announcements. And in the announcements, of course, we have some exciting charts as well. Could you please go to the mic and introduce yourself?
So since we are all extremely tired, this is Yesha from Israel. What are you unhappy about, and what are you unhappy about?
Well, that'll be my straight man opportunity to close the meeting. So let me talk about what I'm unhappy about and also what I'm happy about as a way of closing the meeting. We have time, so if people want to just come up in the middle and interrupt the closing, that's fine as well. But, you know, I started W3C just a few months ago. My tenure at W3C was still counted in days. We've gotten past hours. It was still counted in days when there was the famous article that showed up in Wired magazine, "The Web is Dead." Now, you know, like I felt like I'm starting this new position and I'm walking in and everyone's walking the other way. So I was unhappy about that for a while. So I thought actually that TPAC would be a good, you know, personal test for me to answer the question, is the web dead? I mentioned earlier today that one of my responsibilities as chair, a technical program chair for TPAC, is that from time to time I needed to summarize what went on during the day. So my summary for the day is that the web is not dead. When you consider the function, the scope, the excitement that was exhibited by all the people, I mean, we spent only one day, but we had about 40 people presenting, all new ideas, all exciting ideas. I worry how we're going to marshal all of that and get it all done. We're certainly not dead. The subtext, of course, is that you can't always believe what you read in the press. So there are many points underneath that as well, which we'll save those for the beer. I'm just going to proceed with announcements unless this is last call for issues, opportunities, self-promotion. Thank you.
I hear self-promotion, so. So for self-promotion, I'm talking about a conference that his name is XML Prague that probably some people know about it here in this room. So if people know about it, you can make some noise to say that probably it's the best conference in the world. So who agrees? Who agrees? Well, Lola, Nana.
Hum.
It's better. Okay. So it's in March 26 and 27 in 2011 in Prague. A very nice city is anyway. So, and the nice area we are in, hosted in a very nice university called Charles University. And we are also co-hosting a lot of W3C meeting. If people want to be in Prague before the conference, then they are welcome to yell at us. And so you can go to xmlprague.cz, which is the website, and send an email to info@xmlprague.cz if you want information. I say that because W3C is also involved in this conference. Of course, W3C is one of our favorite, probably the best sponsor of this conference, is a communication sponsor, that because we need that, and we are very pleased to have this relationship with W3C, and we want to spot it. So, member discount is very easy. This conference is only three dozen of euro. It's free. It's 30 euro to entrance. So there's no discount for the conference because it's very cheap. It's even less the price than for the food and the beer, because there is a lot of beer. People can say that. And there is some pictures to demonstrate it, indeed. So anyway, so it's... well, you should delete, yeah. Probably your... No, probably not. So anyway, it's a very good conference, and anybody wants to come, I'm very, very pleased. The CFP is already out. It's XML and the web. So probably the web is not dead and XML is not dead too. So every people is welcome to make contributions and propose any way to communicate around this conference. And I will be very pleased to give more information about it if needed.
Thank you very much.
Julian Reschke, I can't help noticing that the ITF meeting in Prague starts on the week after that meeting, so maybe people interested in both protocols and XML have 2 weeks to spend in Prague.
Thank you. We are considering having a community group on scheduling web and internet-related meetings. Anne.
I just wanted to observe, Kai beat me to the punch in the IRC channel. This seems to me to be about the quietest meeting I think I've ever been at, including me. This might be the first time I've been at the mic all day, which is a record. So, yeah, why is this? The room is really, really crowded, and it's been all kinds of interesting topics and so on. So I don't know what the answer is, and I don't know what else was said in the channel since I stood up. Europeans are quieter. We've met here before, though.
No, it's probably only because there was not a lot of time for questions.
Period.
No, we haven't really had lists of people being turned away at the mics. It has been quiet. I've got the impression, I just feel that the jet lag is not working for people. For a lot of people, that a lot of people, when the talk stops, then they want to take a few minutes to close their eyes rather than go and get up to get a walk. I don't know. But, or the other possibility, so Carl, where's Carl? You said something very positive about the spirit of this meeting at this meeting. And maybe it is that actually everybody's busy. And they've got stuff to do, and actually, you know, they've figured out what they need to do, and they're reporting on it and things, but it's not that, you know, that actually what's top of people's minds isn't their complaint with what other people are doing, and maybe it is that things are fitting in a bit more, and, you know, people have got jobs that they feel that they need to do, and in the spare time there, you know, maybe in fact by just continuing to talk here, we're preventing people editing documents and submitting the moment that the moratorium is over.
I think Charles was next.
Charles, yeah. Actually, what he said. I think, I don't know, I'm tired. Actually, I think the stuff here has been good. Say, you know, there's no reason to come up and rip holes in people because mostly, you know, with a few exceptions that have been noted and picked up on, they've been saying sensible things.
Ileana Luca, AT&T, and I'm here because of Anne. I think it was an excellent session, many new ideas. It was like a popping environment. But I think in the same time, maybe at least 50% of this room are not English speaking, and in the native, and in this case, you need some time. First of all, to understand the new idea, to appreciate it, and by the time you react, the 3 minutes are done. Mm. Thank you.
Okay. Mm.
Yeah. And I just wanted to, I agree. Ileana turned around to say that, make that comment to me, which I encouraged her to go to the mic and make it, because it's such an important point that, we've talked, at least in the advisory board, we've talked about this before, what we could do to help solve that problem. And so anybody in the room, maybe not at the mic, who wants to submit suggestions would be really, really valuable because this is such a loss of participation. I remember also at a previous meeting, I said something, I sat down, the guy sitting next to me who was French, a very good English speaker, turned to me and said, blah, blah, blah. And I said, go to the mic and say that. And he said, I could say that, but I might not understand the response, you know, fast enough. So it's not only just saying something, it's the interaction part. And so it's something we need to work on and seek input.
Yeah. Good.
Some people thought of Paul Cotton, co-chair of the HTML working group. Everyone can hum. No, and in fact, I'm sort of sarcastically making that point because there were some people that came up to me after and said, why did you do that? And one of the reasons was that I had the same reaction as other people, that there wasn't enough participation. And when Larry actually suggested it to me, and since it followed up on the IETF session earlier in the day, it seemed like a great way of getting wider participation in what was going on in the room, regardless of your mother tongue. But on a separate point, I do a lot of international standards work at JTC1, and one of the rules in that forum is the meeting only goes as fast as the slowest person's understanding of what's being said. And in many cases, what people have to do is help the non-English speakers by restating questions and restating answers. And I'd like to encourage everybody to actually think about facilitating everybody's participation in working groups or meetings like this, to repeat questions slowly, and in some cases actually thinking about repeating the answer slowly so that you make sure that you're engaging everyone in the room. And that's just simple politeness to your peers, because imagine what you would feel like if this meeting was being held in Russian or in a language where you either were trying to listen to simultaneous translation or it wasn't your mother tongue. So there are some things that we can do as working group participants and even in some cases as chairs to try and facilitate everybody's participation. And I'd like to encourage people to think about that. Thank you.
Phil Archer, W3C. In every sense, I am a native English speaker, and I have had the privilege and do have the privilege of touring the world and meeting many people and friends from around the world. I can tell you that I am eternally grateful to all the hours and hours and effort that so many people put into speaking my language. I haven't reciprocated. I have no idea how to speak any other language, and we are all very grateful, and we recognize that. That wasn't what I was going to say particularly. I just have another issue to raise, which is just a point by the side. Maybe one reason for quietness is the web being a victim of its own success. If you look back at some of the early specs that we all depend on so much, look at the early XML specs, look at the early RDF and other SAMweb specs and so on. Where are the people who wrote those? They're too darn busy using those specs and making a living out of it to come back here to write version 2. Real concern with the new work on RDF is all the people who wrote RDF 1 are too busy to come back and do RDF 2. And that's an issue that may or may not be a big one in future, but some of the names, people you really want to be in the room, can't be because they're too busy doing it.
That's a good point. Brother, could I comment, just make a comment about the understanding English? I could prefix it with apology because I am probably one of the fastest and most mumbly English-speaking people around. If I see an English, native English speaker cocking her ear so that she can actually understand what on earth it is that I'm saying, I wonder whether... I find that if I'm having difficulty listening to somebody, understanding somebody, I often do tend to have a quick look to see how the scribe is trying getting it in IRC. Often it is really hard for the scribes, of course, as well. But I wonder whether a possibility would people find it useful to have the IRC channel with the simultaneous scribing projected on the side so you can have a quick look at that? Would that be useful? I detect more than a hum. Okay, Ian, who's keeping the list of to-dos for next time? Okay.
Just to note, we will close the queue after Harry.
Liam Quinn, W3C. Actually, Tim, you took some of the words out of my mouth. That's great. Someone pointed out to me that one reason we have fewer questions is that people are making more productive, more people are making more productive use of IRC and the second IRC channel at this meeting than in the past, which is great. It leads me to wonder, we're doing very interesting things with collaborative scribing and the Zakim bot, and people can use the // notation to correct things people have said, and they can add to the scribing. Projecting it would be great. What about experimenting with simultaneous translation? Would that be useful to people? Does anyone have any thoughts on that?
Simultaneous translation to IRC, maybe? Yeah. You mean taking the minutes in two languages at once?
I mean, I think it would be a great idea to do that if we only had the skilled people who were able to do that. I mean, that's, you know, well, so the ones, so anyone who would like, who thinks, I mean, it's not easy, actually, for professionals even. So anyone who would like to volunteer for that, let's try it as an experiment and see how it works out.
How many languages?
Well, you'd have, picking the language is the second language.
So, actually, it's quite interesting, and I've been at conferences and done that, and you can make it work. You need people who are bilingual, and you need some kind of an audience. So people at this conference, I guess, speak Japanese, Chinese, French, German, Korean.
Norwegian.
Nein. Australian's not a language, mate. It's a way of life. Yeah, I think it'd be interesting to think about doing it. The trick is to find people who are prepared to stick up their hand and do it. If you look at the scribing minutes in general, sometimes they're very, very detailed. For my own reasons, I always try and take close to verbatim minutes. Sometimes they're not very detailed at all. So you'll get patchy quality, but big deal. Yeah. If you get some information and it's useful, people will say, hey, this is really useful. If you don't, the scribes will get demotivated and stop doing it. So give it a fly.
I was going to say it later, by the way, but as long as we're on the topic, I'll say it now. When I was thanking people earlier, the one group that I neglected to thank was the scribes. And so thank you very much to all the people who volunteered to scribe today. Yes.
Daniel from Samsung. As a one of non-English native, I really appreciate Anne and everybody for taking care of non-native people participation. But I think we have to make sense. There are so many culture differences, right, in Asia and Europe and even U.S. That's one of the reasons how not so much speak up our opinion in that meeting. So I think we need a little bit more time to speak up, and then I think I have to do, and I have to speak up more things at the next TPAC. But frankly speaking, really appreciate WCC is pretty kind and pretty helpful for us and pretty good to me, and as well as many non-native speaking people, I guess. Thank you very much.
Kazuki Ashima from WCC. So I just wanted to mention that WCC provided simultaneous translation service for the Web on TV workshop in September, and I believe it was very, very useful for getting opportunity opinions from Korean guys and Japanese guys. Yeah, thank you.
And I just like Harry Halpin, W3C, University of Edinburgh. So I'd like to follow up the translation point from a broader perspective. So with IAN's community group effort, one of the more challenging things I've had to do personally is, I'm living in Scotland, doing outreach to developers in San Francisco. At least we all speak English, even though the time zones are crap, trying to communicate. I would be interested in how people think the W3C can get in touch with developers who may not even be aware of the W3C in, emerging economies, Brazil, of course, China, Russia, and there's a lot of countries that aren't here at all, where there's probably web developers with really good ideas for possible standards. And then the second thing I would like to hear some sort of feeling on is there's been some discussion of having, sort of time-based requirements for rec process things. But also I think one thing I think that I've had like to see clarified, and I would like to see feedback from the general membership on this, is what does it really take to start a working group in the W3C? Are there really strict conditions on this? Should we say maybe we shouldn't launch a working group unless we have major vendor support? Unless we, so for example, in some activities, you can have three research institutions start a full-scale working group, and others you need a lot of support from browser vendors. I would just like to hear people out on what they think the reasonable conditions for that should be, because I'm not quite sure of them myself, to be honest.
So that, I'd like to just quickly respond to Harry and, to a certain extent, to Larry Macinta, who, when he put up his slides, and we all had to hum about whether we felt A or B. For many of the things and the questions add different attitudes in Larry's slides, and in fact, it's different for every working group. When we started this thing, the W3C earlier was very much based around activity statements, and so my rule was that the activity statement had to answer all those questions, had to say for this activity, what's the deal? Is it led by industry or is it led by academics? Is the goal to get out a really beautiful spec or is the goal to get out a spec by the day after tomorrow? Because all these things are different. I think it's really important that W3C does not turn that we think about the answer to those questions, but we don't decide that for all W3C working groups the answer should be the same. So in a way, I think there must be lots of routes to get there, and there must be lots of different types of working group. We should remember that the working group idea is a weapon that we've developed, and we use it it's a tool we use for doing things, and we should keep it as a fairly flexible tool, and we should use it in the way we need to use it. We should never build something which then constrains us any more than we give ourselves these constraints to make sure we get through, to make an interoperable specification and to make something that has consensus. But within that, each different area of activity tends to have really different answers.
Thanks, Tim. So I'd like to thank Harry for broadening the topic of language. It's not only language, it's cultural norms. And, one of the important cultural norms that it's important for people to learn is how to come up to the microphone after the queue has been closed. I'd like to ask Rigo and Ian to please demonstrate that cultural norm. No, go ahead. It's okay.
Okay, great. So I have two things to say. So the first is...
Let's get that blood on the floor.
New members, don't look at this. Don't look at this. This is not exemplary behavior.
The first is, I mentioned it would be great for the new community groups to have a shiny new landing page where it was really to understand how I get stuff done at W3C. At the current time, we don't have a lot of funding for that infrastructure and that design, so if you'd like to participate in that, please contact me. Second comment is a plug. Tomorrow night we have a meetup here at the conference center between 7 and 9. Everybody is invited. There are about 150, I would guess, local developers and designers who have signed up, and there'll be free food and wine, and the advisory board will be drinking there, I think, as well. So I just wanted to let everybody know between 7 and 9 tomorrow. Thank you.
There you go.
Yeah, and Ian just said to me, go before me. Before you made the remark. There was a lot of chat in the back channel, IRC back channel, where we searched for creative ideas to generate some tempest for more discussion. I had a creative idea, but you closed the queue, so I spare it.
Thank you. Although it will be featured in next year's TPAC. I have a number of announcements, which are very, very important. So I'd just like to ask you to bear with me for another couple of minutes, just in terms of what is the schedule that's coming up for us in TPAC and a few other selected announcements for the web community in general.
Bill Dowell.
Yeah, I got it. First of all, what's the next thing that we're going to all do?
Reception.
No, close.
End this meeting.
End this meeting? No, you're borderline. Thank you. So please fill out the evaluation survey, and especially for those people that were reluctant to come to the microphone, your feedback is especially important. Yes, then the following thing at 7 o'clock p.m., 1900 hours, is the reception on level 2. And now that we've learned that in little 3-minute increments people can't get the questions asked, and also even if they can ask the questions they might not understand the answer,
I would ask everyone to please feel free to use the reception time to approach those people that you wanted to ask questions. And I'd like to encourage everyone to be very receptive and answer the questions and make sure that we use the time effectively. So that will be this evening. After that, the technical plenary is not over. We have two more days of meetings, so everyone is encouraged to continue to be productive at your meetings. As Ian already noted, we have a public meetup, which is free to the public. You can get the details off the website. It's at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. It's focused on web designers, the gaming community, and so forth, mostly from the general Lyon community. There are an unlimited number of future conferences related to web technologies. Some that I've been asked to bring to your attention. The next multilingual workshop will be in March in Pisa. So certainly for those people around here, you're encouraged to attend that one. WWW this year is also in March. The WWW conference, it'll be in Hyderabad. And those who are able to make it to Hyderabad are encouraged to be there. As noted earlier in the day, there will be a web TV related workshop sometime in the spring in Europe, exact date not yet finalized. And ordinarily, I would not be advertising for 2012 conferences, but WWW in 2012 happens to be in this very same conference center in Lyon. So if you like the arrangements, you're encouraged to come back. For people on our advisory committee, many of you know that our next advisory committee meeting will be in May in Bilbao. Ordinarily, being in the advisory committee meetings is limited to the advisory committee, and in fact, that's the case here as well. But in this particular case, there are going to be a number of companion meetings going on at the same time, which might be interesting to other people as well. So I'd like to ask Xavier to please come up and take us through a few slides just to give us a little feeling, sense the excitement of what's coming up in our schedule.
Thank you. Thank you. So I wanted to present the best conference of the world, but somebody has presented before. So I will present the second best conference of the world. So, as you know, we are going to do the AC meeting. I am Xavier Uribe Echevarria from Mambota Company, and together with the AC meeting, we are going to do a parallel event. We call now W3B because of Bilbao and business, because we want to focus on recruiting new members, new companies. So what will be the parallel event? It will be a global conference made by experts and also organizations and companies that we will discuss about the future, the present of the web, and also recruit new members. I want to remark that because it's one of the important things. Where will be? It will be in Bilbao. And what is Bilbao? The city. This is Bilbao. This is some photographs of Bilbao. As you see, the Guggenheim Museum. This is the same architect as the headquarters of W3C, Frank Gehry. It's made by. So what is Bilbao? It's one of the most developed regions of the world. It has been awarded a World City Award this year. It's the Nobel Prize of the city, so we are lucky. It's the third most innovative city of the world. 2 weeks ago, we saw that on press after London and Chicago. And the best thing that I want to remark there to and invite you to come is that everything is together: hotels, center of the city, conference center, shopping, Guggenheim Museum, everything is in a half a mile. So I invite you and I encourage you to come and have one day of vacation that and see the city, because it will be nice for you, and we will help you to find everything and to have a comfortable venue. And also one thing that we want to remark is the support that we have. Everything is involved in Bilbao, the city hall, the mayor of Bilbao, the president of the Basque president, the Spanish government, everything is involved. So that's, and the facilities. What are the facilities? We are going to do the event in the best, in the world best Palace of Congress in 2003. It's awarded by the community, so of Palace of Congress, so it's a great award. We want to fill 202,000 people in one day, so there will be it will be a big event for the community. So with marketing and everything to know, we want to do webcasting also and everything. This is a prize. Is the biggest stage of Spain and the second biggest of Europe. So, and after that, we will do a gala in the Guggenheim Museum atrium. So you also are invited. It's free for AC members. It's everything free for you. So we encourage you to come. And this is the schedule. We will start on Sunday, registration and intro day. Then AC meeting, and after the AC meeting, we will have the plenary session in the auditorium of 2,200 people, and after that, a gala cocktail in the Guggenheim Museum, and maybe we will give some awards. And the next day, in May 18, in the 18th of May, we will continue the event. Some of you are speakers, some others are attendees, so we also invite you and see you there, and we hope you will be fine in our city. Thank you.
Thank you, Xavier. Unfortunately, we do not yet have the venue for TPAC 2011, but we will get that information to you as soon as we have it available. With that, we are completed with this meeting, and we'll see you all in an hour for the reception. Thank you.